Hi everyone, I have got a bunch of stuff to cover today, so I'm going to jump right into it. This may actually be a long one because there's a couple of things in particular this week that kind of riled me up, kind of got a lot of input and interest from people as well. So first thing, I wrote in my Security Sense column about how responsible are companies when partners lose their data. And you've seen a couple of cases recently where I've spoken about specific incidents. So first of all, Red Cross Blood Bank down here in Australia about a month ago now lost hundreds of thousands of customer data, or even millions. There's so many data breaches now I start to forget. Let's call it a lot of data. They had a lot of data exposed because someone put their backups of the database on publicly facing web servers in a folder with directory browsing enabled, which kind of made it even worse. So they did that, and then we had this Michael Page thing just the other day, where Michael Page, the global recruitment company, had their data exposed as well by Capgemini, who was their partner, their consulting service, big multinational, we will do all your techie things for you company. Now, that one was kind of interesting. It really wasn't handled anywhere near as well as the Red Cross situation. I'm going to write about that a little bit more in detail sometime in terms of the way we actually handle breach notifications and disclosures. But what I found interesting about the Michael Page piece is that someone in a news piece wrote a comment. They quoted some technical person, security person, and this comment says, "It is fundamental that businesses take responsibility for scrutinizing their partner's security prowess." Now, what's being implied here is that Michael Page should have done a better job of making sure that Capgemini weren't going to lose their data. And on the one hand, I can see what is being said here. You know, it's kind of like in a very suit-wearing sense, makes sense that a company would make sure that the company who is going to handle their web things isn't going to then put database backups on a publicly facing web server with directory browsing enabled. That looks good in a PowerPoint deck. Now, the reality is much more complex because what it's saying here is that somehow Michael Page would have been able to assess Capgemini to the degree of confidence where this sort of thing wouldn't have happened. They would have seen a red flag somewhere. I don't think there'd be a checkbox saying, do you publish database backups to a publicly facing web server? Probably not that. But the implication is that somehow this could have been headed off. And I really don't like that because I have been on the Michael Page side in my very corporate-y life. So many times we would have external vendors build software for us. And I would go through this big assessment process, and there's so many documents and checkboxes. And the vendors would always say that they're awesome, right? So the Capgeminis of the world would go, yeah, of course, you know, we do everything well. No problems. We've got processes and documents and people that review it and all of these wonderful things. And I guess the point I was getting to is that it is enormously hard from a self-assessment perspective, even if they're audited, it's enormously hard to make sure that an incident such as one person in one corner of a 180,000 strong employee company isn't going to do something stupid. Now, none of this changes the fact that Michael Page has to take responsibility for the leak in terms of their customer-facing communication. They're the ones who have to say to their customers, yes, your personal info kind of got exposed. Behind closed doors, they would have Capgemini over a barrel. No doubt about it. But I think the real point I want to try and draw on this is that these assessments and this sort of view that the business could take responsibility for scrutinizing their partner's security in such a way that this wouldn't happen is ridiculous. Just have a look at how many PCI-compliant companies get very hacked. So that was Security Sense. I'll link to that. You know, that's a short piece, but that is the sort of thing that I think is just out of touch with reality. Now, the one that got the real interest was around ad blockers. And some of you may have read, and some of you may have seen, and you certainly have heard me if you've watched these videos before or listened to the podcast, which is now available, that I have sponsorship on my blog. So What I do is every week I have a sponsor who pays some money to sit in this little banner across the top of my blog. If you go to troyhunt.com, you'll see it there. This week it's Securi. And it's a little message that says, what do they actually say? Let me check what they're saying this week. So they say, sponsored by, this is my little bit, Securi Incident Response, Monitoring, DDoS Mitigation, and WAF for Websites. Which is great. No flashy banners, no flash or other crap like that. No loading of trackers, no iframes, none of the things that upset people so much. No performance problems. There's a tiny, tiny little asynchronous request which is made to load that data. So this is great, and people loved this when I launched it. They said, well, this is fantastic. You've gotten rid of what was three different ads that I'd have on there at the time. So they're gone. People happy with that. The sponsors are happy because they've got a really good spot there. And they're also people that I speak to, I communicate with directly, and I load on there because I'm happy with what they do. So this is not like, here's a space, put whatever crap you want in it. This is someone who is doing something which I think is worthwhile. I've rejected people who I don't think are doing things that are worthwhile because that's not something that I want to implicitly promote. So they're happy with that. I'm happy because, frankly, it pays a lot more money as well than ads. These ads are very sort of low value space, if you like, because they're not particularly well targeted, even with all the tracking and everything. People sort of, you know, put the blinkers on and move past them. And the other thing that makes traditional ads lower value is people run ad blockers. Because of so many of the problems we have with ads, because they're an eyesore, because they've got a lot of crap in them, because they hurt your bandwidth, because they frequently deliver malicious software. All of these things make traditional ads bad, and the sponsorship arrangement, like is on my blog just there now, good. Fantastic. However, I had people say to me, did you know that ad blockers such as Adblock Plus are blocking your sponsor message? Now, the first time this happened, I was like, well, this can't be right. Why would you block a sponsor message? This is not an ad in the sense of it is doing all of these things that upset people so much. You know, the flashy stuff, the loading external content, delivering malware, the tracking doesn't do any of those things. Must be a false positive. So I had a look at my CSS and I found that I had the word sponsor in there. And I thought, okay, well, maybe the ad blockers are just sort of going through going, all right, well, this is sponsor. So we'll just auto block it. And I changed the word sponsor to message of support. And I thought I was very clever, right, when I did this, because suddenly it all worked again. And I was like, okay, well, this is good. You know, clearly this isn't the sort of content that people are upset about, so everything will be fine. However, we kept seeing blockers block it. They came back. It started getting blocked again. And multiple people sort of came to me and went, hey, just so you should know, because obviously they were thinking that this was some sort of false positive or wasn't something that should be happening. And when I delved into it, what I found was it had specifically been blocked via a service called EasyList. Now, EasyList, for those who don't know, and I didn't know until I delved into this, is effectively a massive long list of tens of thousands of websites, including the names of the elements or the CSS classes on the elements that should be blocked. Not because they've got content which ticks those boxes of eyesore, users, plugins, malware, tracking, bandwidth, hog, yada, 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 but just because they decide they don't want to see them. And the penny that dropped and the arguments that ensued after this was that there's a school of thought out there which is not let us block things because they pose those problems I keep rattling off. Let us block it just because we don't want to see it. We want the content, we want it for free, and we don't want to see anything on your page that we don't want to see. Because reasons. Now, I can kind of get this to a point. Like, we fast forward through ads on recorded TV when we used to record TV. We probably visually flick through them when they're in the newspaper or something like that. But I think the thing that frustrated me enormously was that I was trying to do the right thing by having this sponsor message to get rid of all the things that people don't like. And I was upset that there were active attempts, not just by Adblock Plus, who uses EasyList, but uBlock Origin as well. Many others have since popped up. Active attempts by these to remove responsible advertising. Now, I don't care if you call it a sponsor message or an ad or whatever the hell you want to call it, but I was upset that here I was trying to do something which still does the monetization thing. We need to have monetization on content or else outlets disappear. And it's not that my blog would disappear if I wasn't monetizing it, but it would be a lot harder to justify the amount that I contribute. So I was trying to find a way to do that responsibly, and to then have this sort of case where that is being blocked, I think sets a really dangerous precedent. We really want to try and find a way to do advertising in a way that doesn't create the negative, painful, high friction experiences we've done them before. And this is it, you know, this works beautifully. So anyway, that blog post went out. There were 200 comments within 22 hours. Some of them mine, but a lot from other people. And look, I think the general consensus was sort of outraged that this was happening. But there are a lot of people as well who were just very much of a sort of weird comments in there. You know, things like information wants to be free. I don't know how information makes a conscious, sentient decision about being free, but apparently wants to be free. And that, you know, everything should be a free-for-all. And it's just one end of the extreme. And the whole title of this blog post was that ad blockers are part of the problem. Because when they block efforts to be responsible as well, it perpetuates this nasty cycle. So that was that. When I wrote this, I'm pretty candid. I'm especially candid in these videos because they're not kind of scripted or rehearsed or reviewed or anything. But in the blog post, I was very candid. I swore a few times, not badly, by my standards at least. But, there was like one F-bomb and a few other words that were really, really minor, in my view. And I was really surprised that there are several different people who, after reading this big piece about the problems we have with advertising and how we need to try and improve this for the betterment of society and so that we can all have a better web browsing experience, the thing they decided to focus on was several little four-letter words. And, yeah, look, I'm not going to make apologies for swearing several times in a blog post, in context, mind you, I thought it was very relevant swearing, about something that did actually give me quite an emotional reaction. So I'm just surprised that people felt that this was important enough that it deserved comment space over and above the really important issue in most people's view. So, you know, look, just goes to show, honestly, it is really hard to write just about anything these days without some people finding something that they don't like with it. All right, so that was that. That was the ad blockers. Now, another one that came up, which was also controversial. I seem to have had a lot of controversial stuff this week. Incidentally, controversial stuff does get a lot of readers. So a lot of people came and read my blog this week, which is good for the sponsor, for those who could see it that weren't using an ad blocker. I digress. So I wrote this other piece, and this was around the way personal data is handled. And it was in relation to this sort of geeked in GitHub thing that I spoke about last week. And I called it Handling People's Personal Data is Sensitive Business. And what I really wanted to sort of touch on here is that from that geeked in post that I wrote, there was a lot of divisive views here around whether or not it mattered geeked in were doing what they're doing. Because if you recall, what they were doing is they were scraping data off GitHub, including my data, and then building it into effectively a commercialization platform for recruiters. You know, they would sell information about individuals. And I put this poll out, and the poll was effectively saying, this is a poll on Twitter, effectively saying, look, you know, do you care about what geeked in was doing? And there are a few different options. 66% of people were not happy. So 2/3 of the audience were not happy about what was happening. Only 9% said they couldn't care. Couldn't care less, I think I phrased it. Now, I found that interesting because that is a very, very heavily skewed result towards we're not cool with this. And in the blog post, I went through and I grabbed a bunch of comments that were left on a LinkedIn post by the guy who originally launched the Geeked In service. And they are scathing. I mean, they're not just scathing in terms of, you know, what you did was stupid and unethical and all that sort of thing. Scathing even legally, saying, okay, well, now you're going to have legal issues in the EU, but in particular in the EU, because the EU is very privacy orientated. Plus, this guy is in Spain and he was hosting in Poland, so it's all over that corner of the world. And people were really, really upset about this. There was no messages at all of support for the guy, except for one person who I believe has a working relationship with him. So people were very upset about this. And what I boiled this down to is that even though the data was public on GitHub, this individual went and grabbed it and he used it in a way that people didn't expect it to be used. Now, you can argue all day long that if you put it on GitHub and it's publicly facing, then, you know, what else can you expect? It's going to happen. But that doesn't change the fact that this is the way people feel as a result. They feel that they provided data to be used in a particular way, and yes, it was out there publicly facing, but then it was used in a different way, and it was used to make money, and in convention, by violating GitHub's terms and conditions as well. And a lot of people sort of said, look, there is no recourse. You know, once it's public, that's it. It's a free-for-all. Not really true, because there are legal recourses available if you have terms and conditions on a website that are violated. And again, look, you can argue that it is publicly facing, people should be able to do whatever they want with it. But legally, if it is publicly facing and people violate the terms and conditions, there can be recourse. Now, GitHub is not going to take this guy to court or not going to do anything legal about that. You know, it's just one person who's certainly feels pretty bad about what happened by now, I reckon. But the point is that just because that data is out there doesn't mean you can do whatever you want with it. So that was kind of interesting, just to sort of see the controversy. And whether you agree or don't agree, it's just important to remember that there is a huge portion of the population that feels this way, that feels that the data should not be misused in other ways. And whether you disagree or agree with it, if you're the person who's creating another service that's scraping that data, you've got to expect you're going to have problems if you do something like that. So I was geeked in GitHub. Another one, and this was just yesterday my time, was I wrote about loading spam lists into Have I Been Pwned. Now, earlier last week, someone sent me a spam list with over 30 million people on it. Now, this wasn't just a spam list in terms of, well, there are like, I think it was about 33 million email addresses. It was email address, name, address, date of birth, gender, IP address. It was basically exactly what I would find in a data breach. And the only thing that wasn't consistent with the sort of data I'd get from most data breaches was that there wasn't a password. Now, this data, I had written about this sort of practice before, actually, earlier this year. I'd written about how your data gets harvested from things like those free online surveys. So you know how you fill out the survey and you'll win an iPod, honestly, like we'll send, it's in the mail, right? You fill that out, you give them your personal data, they then sell this as part of spam lists. Now, I put another poll on Twitter last week. I'm finding the polls are kind of handy to get a sense of community sentiment. And I said, look, should data like this be loaded into Have I Been Pwned? Over 1,000 people answered, 85% of them said yes. It was just a yes or no poll. So that was a pretty emphatically positive result for yes, load the data. So I thought a lot about how to do it. And what I've ultimately done is, first of all, there's a flag on the breach entity, which is in Have I Been Pwned, which says it is spam list. So for anyone using the API, it's easy to filter out. It is very, very clear everywhere in the description, everything from the title of the incident through to the description of it, that it is a spam list. There is a link through to the blog that I wrote about loading spam lists, which explains why I'm doing this. So if anyone gets this message, you know, you like gets a notification from Have I Been Pwned or searches the live website and finds himself in there, there's plenty of background, plenty of explanation. Now, there's sort of some pros and cons to doing this. And one of the cons, frankly, is that if you find yourself in a spam list, what do you do? And I've had comments on the blog post since I wrote it, where people did find themselves in the spam list and they're upset, right? They're upset that they're in that list, but what's the recourse? And the only thing I've been able to say is, well, look, here's the guy selling the list. You know, get in touch with him. But even then, what are you going to do? It's been resold, redistributed. But unfortunately, that's not completely different to what happens after a data breach, right? Your data is out there. Now, what do you do? Well, at most, you change your password, but there are plenty of data breaches out there with no passwords as well. Modern Business Solutions, 58 million records in Have I Been Pwned. RegPack, which was some number of hundreds of thousands of credit card transactions. I think 320,000 credit card transactions publicly exposed. No passwords in either of those. And what I originally arrived at in terms of the rationale for loading this is that would people expect to know if I found their data floating around? I'm getting towards 900,000 subscribers on Have I Been Pwned. They have said to me, look, let me know when you find my data out there. And I did, and I found their personal info, and it, like I say, it looks like a data breach. It smells like a data breach. The only difference is a missing password. And they want to know about it, and a lot of people, after they find themselves in Have I Been Pwned, are grateful because they go, okay, well, that helps explain why I was getting all of this spam, or this helps explain other abusive practices I've seen. And that may not emphatically prove that that was the source of any sort of malicious activity that happens against them, but at least it helps them start to join dots about where they've been exposed. So I loaded in a total of about 64 million rows yesterday across two spam lists. Someone else has subsequently sent me another one. I need to look at it and go through all the sort of processes of establishing legitimacy again. But look, I don't think this will ever be anything more than a small single-digit proportion of the database, but that is the rationale of why I've done this. Last thing in terms of content, I wrote another blog post last night. It's a busy blogging week. This is a nice thing about being home. And it was about my new Pluralsight course, The Information Security Big Picture. Now, I really, really wanted to write this course for quite some time because I wanted to write a course that was consumable not just by people like probably you and me being technical people with an interest in security, but other people who need to work with information systems, which is kind of everyone these days. You know, so look around you, for example, at the office. Everyone is creating passwords. They're logging onto systems. They're going to websites. You know, all of this stuff, which is pretty fundamental. And I didn't want to just do a generic old, you know, here's how to do the basics of security. I wanted to try and challenge people's preconceptions about InfoSec. So, for example, I wanted to challenge the perception that if they only go to trustworthy websites, they won't get viruses. So there's this bit in there which was from a semantic study a few years ago where Semantic found that you were four times more likely to get viruses from a religious site than from a porn site. And I'm not necessarily trying to influence your browsing decisions here, but I am trying to make people question how they make value decisions about where they browse and about what is safe. And the reason that Semantic came up with for that incident, by the way, was that porn sites are very, very dependent on audiences trusting them with things like their personal data and their money. So think about it like this, right? And I mentioned this in the blog post. If your church website gets a virus, right? Or let's say they're redistributing malicious software and you browse through there and you get malware on your machine, you're not going to change religion. Probably not going to change religion. You may not be that endorsed in it if you do. However, if you go and browse some adult entertainment and you find that you get malicious software from there, that is a very transient relationship. You'd move on. So there's an interesting rationale. So there's stuff like that. There's a lot of things around. One of my favorite, actually, and I didn't put in the blog post, is that there's been this long-held belief of you should rotate your passwords every 3 months. You know, like if you work in an organization, you do this. Because they force you to. Active Directory starts shouting at you and saying, change your password. And the, you know, like the classic rationale there is, well, if an attacker got your information, you know, anywhere within the last 3 months, well, now they can't use it. And what I really like here is that the British government came out a little while ago and they said, well, no, you shouldn't do that, right? Stop changing passwords because it forces all of these bad behaviors. You know, people post-it noted up on the screen, or they add a one to the end and they just keep incrementing it. We all do it, right? We've all done it. So that, yeah, they said, you know, look, you shouldn't do any of that. And, they actually make a really good point, which is that if hackers get your password, they generally go out and use it straight away. You know, so you've got this sort of up to three-month window, where you can be owned anyway, regardless of your password recycle or password rotation strategy. So there's a bunch of stuff like that in this course, and I really enjoyed writing it because it's stuff in there that I find particularly interesting. There's a bunch of stuff about gummy bears and biometrics and other things that I just think make for really, really interesting watching. It's only just over a couple of hours long. It is a big picture course, which means that it's fairly high level. I don't go down into code or anything like that, but it also means that I get to cover a lot and it's consumable by a lot of people. So look, go and have a look at that. I think it's great. I've obvious bias, but particularly see what it's like if other people watch it as well. Your non-technical others, other people in the office. I designed it so that everyone could enjoy it, and I really hope that that's what actually happens. So go and check that out. That is the Information Security Big Picture. So last thing, I mentioned the sponsor this week. Sponsor is Securi, so they're back again. I think this is about the third week in a row, so you know, kudos to those guys. For the people that were able to see the sponsor message, that worked out fantastically. Incidentally, that Pluralsight course also talks about Forbes, who people would probably trust. Forbes, as you may have seen, forces you to turn off your ad blocker if you want to read the content, and then they have consequently served malware to people on multiple occasions. So you see the way this all ties back in. I like having Securi there because they're a sponsor. I don't have the ads. The ads serve you malware. You should go and watch the course so you learn the fact that those ads will do that, and then also the ad blocker problem. Everything is interrelated this week. That has been a long weekly update, though. There's a lot of stuff in there. I'll link to everything when I publish this video. All those links will be on the blog. Thanks for everyone that's downloading the podcast as well. That's going really well. I should have done that earlier, and I will definitely do that from now on. So thanks very much, folks, and I will be back next week.